Welcome, everyone, to another very special episode of Brainstorm Brewery. This is a very special episode for more than you would think. If you're tuning in for magic, you're not going to get that here. Yes, this is a Magic the Gathering podcast, and if you come in from somewhere else to listen to our guests here, thank you for joining us. My name is Marcel. I'm also joined by my co-host, Ryan Bouchard.
What's up? And then we also have Corbin Hostler here.
Yeah, that's me. Hey, everybody.
Hey, so our special guest is someone I would probably describe best as a futurist. He was a co-founding editor at Wired Magazine. He wrote a book called Out of Control, which is regarded as the prediction of the internet. And right now he has another book that's a New York Times bestseller. It's called The Inevitable. We have Kevin Kelly. Kevin, how are you doing?
Hey, it's really great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
So to jump into this is what's really interesting about Kevin is the way that he takes the perspective of what's going on in technology in the world and just bringing it in a way that's consumable for people. And the big thing about the inevitability is, or the inevitable is that these are forces that are coming at us that we shouldn't be fearing, that we should learn to embrace because it's not something that we can stop. What do you want to tell people about your book or at least get people in? Because I'm pretty sure most people probably haven't heard of it.
Yeah, they haven't likely. It's a new book, only a couple of weeks old, and it's a pretty dense book that is outlining the next 20 to 30 years of digital technology, giving kind of the broad contours of the landscape where we might be. It's not concerned about the specific things. It's not trying to predict what the next iPod or Apple is going to be. It's looking at the larger scale trends that we're kind of governing where we're going, like the fact that we're going to be increasing the amount of tracking that we do. No matter what else happens, there'll be more stuff tracked. No matter what happens, there'll be more stuff shared and collaboration at more higher, larger scales. No matter what happens, there's going to be more AI. No matter what happens, we're shifting from owning things to accessing things. And there are the kind of trends like that. I have 12 of them, but the number's really not that important because they could be sliced and diced different ways. They're all self-supporting. Flowing makes more screening makes more flowing, makes more remixing, all those kinds of things. They're all verbs. I talk about processes rather than nouns and products. That's the other shift, is that we're going away from making solid, immutable, fixed noun products to things that are flows and liquid and processes and services. So that's another large scale shift. So I'm talking about the kind of things at that level, which actually are easier to remember than whether, Google's going to be around or not, because it doesn't really matter.
Okay, so a big question that we've had on one of our associate podcast, Money Draft, was a question about the progress of technology. They said 1970 was a cutoff. Like the 40 years before that, there was so much technological change that impacted human society, and we moved at such a pace that this current past 40 years from like 70 to 2010 has seemed more like incremental change and just minor advances. It doesn't seem as monumental as previously. What do you feel about that, and what do you feel about the upcoming 40 years coming?
Yeah, no, whoever said that is right in at one level. There is far more visible change between my grandfather and his son, my father's day, than there was between my father and my day. And the reason is because that was a product of the Industrial Revolution, which rearranged the physical world like nothing else. We invented artificial power, artificial energy from oil and cheap fossil fuels and electricity. And we had a grid and we delivered all over the world. And that artificial power enabled us to harness power way beyond our own muscles or the animal muscles, and we could just arrange skyscrapers and superhighways and trains and factories and all that was power, all that was made possible because artificial power, and that completely rearranged our visible world. And that has ended. That industrial revolution has happened. What we're doing now is with the intangible world. Is we are rearranging our intangible world, the world of our own identities, the world of meaning, the world of ideas, and that's where all the energy is going to. And so, while the physical world has not changed much from the 70s, your interior world has absolutely changed. You're a far different person than he was from his father or grandfather. And so, and that's where we're going to be continuing in a certain sense in the next 40 years, is we're going to continue that kind of rearrangement of how we see ourselves, how we spend our time, what we're doing. Because I think even 40 years from now, our cities are going to look kind of like what they do right now. There's not going to be a whole lot of change. There'll be self-driving cars and stuff, but, you know, visibly, there's not going to be a super lot of differences. But in terms of the intangible, there's going to be vast differences. Because we will have the presence of artificial intelligences. We will have the presence of connected 7 billion humans connected together. We will have virtual worlds that we're going into. And so all these things will radically change who we think we are and what we do.
So a major point that you made was about AI. And I think that's a huge thing that's going to change the way that we interact and just the how we utilize technology. The big thing you mentioned was Cognifying, where we're moving into the point where industrial revolution was putting artificial power to tools and making them more efficient. Now we're moving to the point where we're adding AI to these same tools and making them more efficient and interconnected. Do you think that this is just micro advancements and that these are just ways to make ourselves more convenient? Or where do you see this really being revolutionary bounds that will impact society?
I think the coming disruption from artificial intelligence as it comes into full force, and it may take a generation to do so, will overwhelm the industrial revolution plus the printing revolution and maybe even reading and writing altogether. I mean, I think it's so profound. So the industrial revolution unleashed all this power, and we could drive down the highway right now with 250 horses equivalent under a hood. Now we're going to add 250 mines to it, and we have the robocar. But I mean, it's like so much of what we're interested in is in this thinking aspect, this adaptive, this learning, this in some ways, this lifelike aspect that we get when we animate things with artificial smartness. It's like making our technology more lifelike, more living. It's like it's changing into kind of like an ecosystem, like a forest or a meadow instead of a factory. And I think that's just incredibly powerful, and it's going to touch all aspects of our life. I haven't yet been able to think of some aspect where you were adding some artificial smartness and artificial intelligence doesn't really fundamentally change the nature of it. And so I think it's not just a little fashionable hype. I think in the near term, sure, but the next 5 years, it may take a while. But I think in the long term, or even in the short term, like 20 years, 30 years, I think we're underestimating how disruptive it will be. Changing the nature of our work, not necessarily replacing it, but just changing the nature of it, to changing how we understand or do, you know, the food, education, the military. It's all going to be affected. There was a really interesting survey done recently by the Pew Foundation, and I replicated it at a large talk with 200 people. We had some instant polling things, and so we asked the question, you know, how many of today's jobs would you expect to be eliminated in like 50 years? And there was some, I don't know exactly what the formula was, but it was a very high number of like 80% of the people said, yeah, there's 50% of the jobs are going to be gone. And then we asked the same question, how many people think their own job is going to be eliminated in 50 years? And it was very few. Which is totally crazy. It's like everybody thinks everyone else's job is going to be affected except my job.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks that. So you know that something's not adding up. And I think that's the level that we're at. It's not that these jobs are going to be eliminated, by the way, which I actually don't believe they're going to be eliminated. I think they're going to be transformed, modified, altered. Because jobs are just a bunch of different tasks that we do, and some of those tasks have to do with efficiencies, and those are the ones that are get roboticized and automated, and others are not. And so some aspects of what we're doing will be taken over, and it would vary depending on the jobs. And mostly we're going to be working with these bots more and more, and we're going to have to get better at understanding and talking to them, knowing how they work, becoming part of it, just as most people today use Google, which is an AI to some extent in their everyday life. And so just imagine that becoming a million times better, and that's sort of what your job is going to be like.
So
you don't think there's ever a point where humans are, I don't want to say pushed out, but I mean, there's such a large percentage of humans comparatively to the amount of humans that you need to actually do things. I mean, what happens when you start pushing that group?
Because so the key thing is do things. And the thing is that we keep inventing stuff that we want done. It's not like a zero sum where what we want accomplished is already fixed. No, the whole point of it is that we're expanding what it is that we want done. You go back 150 years to the farmers in America, 70% of Americans were farmers, 70%. And you have a big box full of pink slips, which you're going to give them and say, hey, look, none of you, basically it's less than 1%, are going to be farmers in another generation. And they would say, what are we going to do? And you say, you're going to be web designers. You're going to be mortgage brokers. You're going to be yoga teachers. And they would say, well, you know, there's no need for web. You know, there was no need for any of that back then. But that was all because all they needed to do was grow food. But we've expanded the things that we want done, and we'll keep expanding that. And most of the things that we want done will actually be initiated by the technology we're inventing, by the AIs. Through AI, we'll discover a whole nother set of things that we didn't even know we wanted until we had AI. And then we discover that there's all these things that we wanted. And basically, in the beginning, we don't know what we want, so it's very messy, and we kind of try stuff, and we don't know what it is. But only after we kind of done it for a while, then we can automate it and give it to the robots to do. So the general trend is that we're going to be spending our time inventing new jobs that we can then later give to the robots. But that inventing part is... And it's not a cerebral. It's not just like smart people are doing it. No. We're being invented by everybody, just by the fact that we have some contact with this stuff and we're using it. Then we get an idea of, oh, this is what I want. I didn't know that I wanted this before, but now I can't live without this.
But we have an issue right now with I think the speed of people having the skills to be able to transfer to a different job or when their job gets replaced. Because right now, I believe you said 50% of the jobs are currently truck drivers. And as we see with automated trucks and cars, that's going to become the forefront of where AI is going to be replacing jobs at a fast rate. So actually getting these people to get skills that can do that quick enough to keep feeding their family, I think is going to be a hard lesson for some people.
I would agree. And first, it's not really 50. It's just that the most common occupation in the U.S. is a truck driver. It's not anywhere near 50, but 50% of those will probably be gone in 20 years or so. And I agree 100% that is going to be that transition will be very painful for many. But there are several things to say about it. One is that I am very impressed by the capability of people to change given the right tools and the right incentive to do so. I think even adults that were far more plastic than we often give credit to, the issue is that they will need help. And I think this is the role of the government. This is why we have governments to help in these kinds of transitions. And so I think it's entirely feasible that we can help. And by the way, it isn't that these people have to become PhDs or whatever, but there's going to be so huge numbers. By the way, all these things, all these self-driving cars have to be repaired. I mean, this is a whole AI repair person is a job, and it's partly manual, partly intellectual. All these trucks, self-driving trucks, will have a whole new set of problems and issues and things that have to be figured out. And there, this is not just about people who are college educated. There's going to be plenty of things that we move to because things that deal with human relations and human interactions are fundamentally inefficient, and humans are only good at that with other humans. And so this is a huge place for people to develop new tasks that we want done.
Right. So while we're on the subject, one of the things I think that obviously is going to be something that the world has to deal with moving forward is, you know, what happens when that AI technology fails? And we had the death of somebody involved with a driverless car recently. And that is obviously something that as the, you know, for lack of a better term, the bugs get worked out in all these systems. You know, how do you view the way forward with that? How to work through those things while not losing sight of, you know, the end goal of where things are heading?
How to work through? Well, I think we are working through it. I think first of all, we need to prepare for a lot more people to die in all driven car. As long as there's less than 1.3 million people
right.
dying a year, then we're ahead. Okay, because humans kill 1.3 million, but for some reason we're not banning humans from driving. It's really peculiar. So I think that we have a lot of room still, but obviously we want to keep it to the minimum. So I think actually the way that Google's doing it is the way I would go, which is I don't think there should be a human handoff. I think that's a mistake. I think you should go all the way with, if you're going to hand off the car, then you should not be expecting it to be handed back to you, because that's just not human nature. Mm-hmm. There may be human handoff things where if you're on the highway and then when you get off the highway, you hand it back. Okay, that makes sense. But I don't think this idea, well, you drive until there's an emergency. No, I don't think that's really the way it should work. So I think there's a couple of things that we want to figure out there. And the important thing, though, is I think that we're working with these things, not against them, that there are kind of there's humans and AIs, and that there may be even for a while where there's certain sections of road or whatever that you actually need to take over. Someone was proposing a really cool new talking about new human jobs. They called them dringers. The idea is that there may be sections where you're entering into that you need to give over to the car and navigate, so that there's kind of local people who like pilots in the harbor who take on your car and drive it through this section and then get out. In other words, these are auto-driven cars with no passengers, like delivery cars. They have to get mm-hmm. through. And so but for some temporary moment, they pick up a human that can navigate them through the hard part, and then the human leaves and they take over again. So I'm not concerned about safety. I'm concerned about some other issues like the ethics and morality. I think this is a much more difficult problem. And here's the problem is that AIs are making decisions. They're making decisions already. They will make more complex decisions. And as they become more complex, we will be unable to discern what the logic is behind their decisions. And they could make decisions that are, say, prejudiced or biased, and we wouldn't even know it until maybe later on. And then we might not know how they arrived at that or be able to easily correct it because we don't know the system. And so the issue of dealing with biases in AIs for whatever reason, for whatever direction, or even understanding the logic of it is going to be very challenging for us to deal with. And we'll want some kind of, I don't know, we'll have to evolve various protocols for dealing with biases and AI intelligences when it's going to be very hard for us to discern whether there is a bias or not. That's the kind of a thing. Go ahead.
Or you may get a company that creates an AI that will keep the driver safer than, say...
Right. They have a bias in the safety of the passenger versus the pedestrian. That's an ethical decision that has no easy, there's no answer to that. I mean, you kind of have to, have a consensus in society that we're going to, go this way, that this is the etiquette. This is the ethics. This is what we do. So that conversation, has to happen. And the reason why, it's very easy for us to actually program in to the machines our ethics, and if we were clear about them, but we're not clear about them. It turns out that we humans have a very poor, inconsistent, and not very deep ethical system, and so it's very hard to transfer that because it's mushy, and so we actually have to refine, and we have to actually develop, and we have to actually deepen. We have to actually make our ethics better in order to teach them to the robots. And so hopefully we might be able to make our own behaviors more ethical by trying to teach them to the robots.
I mean, that makes sense. Like, if you ever tutored someone, you reinforce what you know and almost relearn what you know by teaching somebody else. And then
exactly
trying to explain to the robots how this is. We may find pieces of our humanity we may have lost or got murked.
I don't think we've lost it. I don't think we're talking about recovering. I think we've never had it. I think we're going to grow. We're going to get better as humans. AI and robots will make us better as humans, better than we've ever been before. Because you have to remember that we've invented our ethics. We've invented our humanity. This is not something that, we have created our humanity. We've created humans. Humans were the first animals we domesticated. And so, We are created, invented beings. We've made up our ethics. We are still creating it, and we haven't gotten very far, and we're going to go further with the aid of AI and robots, which will help us define who we are.
I think an interesting point on that was you're talking about centaurs. Like these were chess grandmasters that are combined with the computer that were better than either or by themselves. And I feel like this is like an augmented intelligence, and we're going to have more of this coming about. And when cybernetics and implants become acceptable or socially acceptable, I mean, where do you think there's a line where we have anti-doping for athletes? But what if, is there going to be anti-AI or as such?
Yeah. Well, the college entrance exams kind of attempt to do that with no, with calculators and stuff. There'd probably be several different versions of the Olympics, or whatever, where you don't have AI either. I know that there's been a call for AIs have beaten humans in chess and Go. What's the next benchmark? And so one of the ones being talked about is for an AI to pass the physics AP test or the law exam. And so if they do that, then that would be certainly acceptable to cheating. You could, in some ways, if it can actually become a routine, then you could use it to cheat. So I think you're right. There will be, maybe rooms, Faraday cage proofed rooms that you have to take your test in just to make sure that your AI is not taking the test for you. I definitely think that there'll be versions of that. And at the same time, I'm much more interested in the augmented version of the Olympics and the augmented versions where, like the Centaur League, where you have no rules. It's like free martial arts. It's like do whatever it takes. Who's the smartest? Whether, you know, human plus AI, or even for that matter, Olympics, where you have completely augmented people. That would be pretty cool too.
Take my legs. You can have them. But so one thing, we keep talking about this AI, and it makes me think about, I know I listened to you talk about virtual reality as well. And I remember when I was 12 years old going to Cedar Point, and for the first time they had one of those, you step into the platform and there's like a circle barrier around you, you put on the helmet and that full thing. And that was like really my first glimpse into what virtual reality could be. At the time, you had a very simplistic gun. The idea was, you know, everything is around you in 3D, you shot to places, and I believe it was the barriers on the outside that were probably picking up the signal. And then I see what virtual reality has become in these 15 years. And then we're kind of seeing that evolution a lot more in entertainment, it seems like. And is that because that's a more accepted realm for it to like test it out and see what people think? And now we're seeing like Pokemon Go kind of go in that direction as well. And how long does it take usually to go from an arena like that to people accepting it more into like everyday lives? Because there's a lot of people who, even when our local grocery store switched over to scanning it on your own and stuff like that, people freaked out about that. And that's not even remotely close. So you obviously have this huge subset of people who are just not willing to accept this into their lives. What does it take for those people to finally let that push happen?
Yeah, I mean, the pattern of technological distribution is actually a whole field in itself. And you're right, you've named all these trials, including, you know, when I talk about AI, I talk about the fact that ABS breaks, basically is an old AI chip that breaks better than humans. And people were just completely freaking out in the beginning. Oh, no, I'm not going to use that. I can break myself better. You know, I'm not going to trust this thing, which can crash and stuff. But I mean, this is like a million hours or lives later. They obviously save lives. They break better than humans ever could. Now they're just like standard fare. So there is this kind of yuck factor, this sort of overcoming things. And you know, sometimes people don't overcome it. Google Glass just failed. It was just people didn't get over that. I think it was in partly because of the camera, that word facing camera, because they didn't like to be filmed. It was less about the what you saw, which wasn't really that useful either. But I think that I'm curious about why maybe you stopped going to Cedar Point for the VR. Did it not get better fast enough? Probably not. I mean, my experience with VR in the 80s was that it was really pretty good. Not so far off, say, the Oculus right now. But the problem was, in retrospect, that it was like $1 million in cost, and it was very finicky. And I think one of the reasons why – so what's happened now is that basically the smartphone technology is being borrowed by VR, and you have a commodity price, and so you can do it at commodity prices. But I think still – it's a little, this first generation is still a little touchy, and it requires, you know, kind of someone dedicated to kind of keep going, keep the drivers updated. And I think it's just going to, and you look dorky. I mean, there's no way around it. You put the goggles on, you kind of don't want to go out in the street like that. It's also a safety issue. If you're getting out of your chair and having to roam around the room, you can get bonked. And so, I think entertainment's going to be the main path for the next 5 years, maybe. And then education and teleconferencing, the workplace is to me the second place that's going to happen, where it's more the mixed reality. Less of the completely enclosed virtual reality where you are seeing virtual things, virtual screens, virtual people who are teleconferencing, or diagrams, things to move with your hands, to train with. That's, I'm imagining, is the second step. And I think it's going to be a bunch of years before it becomes like in a, I don't know, I want to say kitchen or on the street or something. I mean, I think that's still a long ways away.
Well, we've kind of got that now with Pokemon Go, even though this is not VR, but this is, and it's not really augmented reality. It's kind of a pseudo, but you now have the social awkwardness. You see people walking around with their phones and looking through it, flicking there, other people that don't understand or like, what is going on with these people? But,
we'll see how long that lasts. And, you know, that's actually what the Google has a big VR team, and they have something called Tango, which is their idea was to take the smartphone and use that as a virtual, the movement of this thing itself. So you could see a 3D thing as the interface. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to do a lot of with that. And there's a couple of demos that were actually pretty cool. You weren't wearing goggles. You were just using the phone, and you would move the phone around and see like a physical, like a couch in your living room. And that couch would be like a couch you were thinking of buying, and you could change the color, you could change the shape, you could make sure it fit in there, you can move it around with your hand. And yet that presence was just kind of assembled just from your smartphone and moving your smartphone different angles and around. And that's actually very effective. So that kind of a pseudo VR, particularly in that kind of augmented reality game, I think, they've shown that works, that's good enough for lots of things. And so there are different kinds. I think there's probably three or four more varieties of the stuff that we haven't invented yet that could, you know, go some way down the line that it's not just the fully enclosed, blacked out VR. It's not, there's spectacle versions. There's this Tango. I don't know what you call it. The pseudo version. And there's probably, more than one mixed reality version as well.
Yeah. I think where it's going to end up is really where the public and the consumers want to take it. Cause it's hard to fight, you know, millions and millions of people as a pressure point, and you want to try to feed them as much as it is. And depending really if Pokemon Go becomes a fad or not, and it goes away in the next 3 months, if it doesn't, I could see it becoming like a platform similar to Facebook that they build upon. And just because the acceptance by so many people that now you'll have people moving into that realm and working within that realm of it.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I was always surprised by with Google when they bought Kehoe and did Google Earth, I kept thinking that's the ultimate game platform. You know, Google Earth, Google Maps, you have a virtual world the size of the Earth, and you could do all kinds of things with this complete simulation of the Earth right there. And you could overlay it. You could do this thing where you're in both worlds at the same time. So I think we're just at the beginning of this, and we don't know what works. And I'm not even suggesting in my book that we do know what works. Those are the specific products that I think you can't predict. I'm saying that we're going to see is more and more interaction with our computers, more and more immersion into them. And that's what's inevitable. It's not inevitable what the specific product looks like. I think that's completely unpredictable, and we can only find out by trying.
That's fair. So there's I suppose, too, when you were saying that, you know, it starts in the entertainment industry, it seems like the media, I mean, obviously with Pokemon Go being a big thing this past week, but then there's also a lot of these movies that are coming out in the next years. Ready Player One comes to mind. I don't know if you've read the book.
I have.
And I think that, is there a push by the, I don't want to say just the media, but by, I guess any of those companies that want to work towards that, they obviously have to set the public up for that. Is that why we're seeing more of this coming out, or is it just coincidental?
I think it's just coincidental. I think, in my experience, there's like hundreds, if not thousands, of startups rushing into this space, and every single big company, media and technological company. I mean, Twitter now has a VR group, and so it's just the. It's not the Hollywoods trying to build up a hype for a movie. It's genuine, crazy, you know, hyper cycle going on right now. And I don't know of a single media company that's not exploring it in some fashion. and the kinds of things you're talking about, as far as I can tell, at the scale of like release in the next couple of years, these are what we would call VR movies and games. So the VR movies is kind of your just a swivel where you are in a seat and you have a display. You're kind of like a Google Cardboard where you can kind of move your head around, look around up and down, and you have the full VR sensation, but it's not like you're not roaming. The game version might have a roaming version. So like Ready Player One, as far as I can tell, might have a game version of that, which Ernie Cline and others Ernie Cline who wrote the book is very excited because maybe that could be turned into the Oasis. But that's not so much the movie version. That's more of a game version of it.
Yeah, and I know people are starting towards that. Like, was it No Man's Sky is coming out this summer, which is kind of the first push towards that. Open creative world where you are supposed to immerse yourself. I know at some point they want to get in with VR technology. Yeah, I just didn't know if the large companies were influenced in any way to, be on the, trend of this and by pushing this kind of into people, like, releasing this movie Ready Player One, people seeing this, walking out of the theater going, wow, that world would be really cool. You know, maybe I'm more interested in, this research, or maybe I'm more interested in getting into this field or something like that if that plays a part. But
It's possible. I know that some of the big VR companies have made or have been making deals with Spielberg or vice versa. I don't know who's who. Spielberg's made a deal with them in terms of, the Hollywood people, they're very cognizant that this is sort of the future direction of entertainment. Not that the movies would ever go away, just that, like Jackson said in my piece, he's bored. He's bored with making another movie. He's not bored with the content. He's bored with that process. So they're all kind of looking for something new and different. And they will push all the buttons that they need to. But I think that there's so many other people also pushing the button at the same time that I don't think their button pushing is really having much effect. I think this is just a very wide, broad rush to a stampede into this space.
Yeah, I've been on many conferences, and stampede is literally what happens when people wanted to go to the HoloLens and to Oculus Rift. Like the flow of the humans that we want is VR, and now it's just within our grasp. And I think a lot of people are excited about that. Now, a lot of people that are excited is the porn industry. I believe that E3, Naughty America was probably the most had the most traffic going on. And there was also in Japan, I believe there was a conference with VR that sold out. So I think we'll see a great push from there because there's so much money in that the leaps and bounds will sadly be from.
Yeah.
Well, I mean
I saw some of the, what they call volumetric capture, which is volumetric live capture. So this is not like motion capture, which is one aspect. And there's not like a 3D bullet capture where they're capturing everything, but it's static. This is a 3D live volumetric. So there's somebody living, and they're moving around, but you can walk in any direction and see them, but it's not live in the sense that it's not real time. So that's kind of the next step that the guys at the HoloLens were actually premiering, which is the second version, which is that they're in 3D volumetric and they're responding to you in live real time. The bandwidth needed to do that is crazy immense, and there's a lot of tech and seven cameras. But the point is that the presence, the feeling of absolutely being there is very, very strong. It's uncannily powerful. And so you really do feel like this person is there. And so in terms of having that presence in porn, I'm sure that will be extremely powerful. And probably in conjunction with other kinds of teledonics, who knows what it is, but I have no doubt that would probably be, successful in terms of, innovating in this space. Absolutely for sure.
I'm sure somewhere down the line, maybe next 50 or 80 years, maybe neurological VR where they're able to get in and you don't have to do this visual thing and you could do senses and everything else along with it.
I tried some of the brain machine kind of interfaces and where you control the computer by thinking about it, and that does work. It doesn't work very well, but it does work. And that's with, you know, it's just with a little bicycle helmet kind of thing sitting on your head, on your scalp. That's not even going inside. And I think that's, will be pioneered, you know, with, therapy first before we do enhancement, you know, people who need it first. But that's, I think your timeline's about right on that.
And through that, I think in these VR worlds, we're going to see, people with disabilities, I believe, become more ingrained with society and not feel like they're on they're marginalized. And because they're able to work on, say, their brain and not have to work on body, that they'll be able to spend more time in these virtual worlds as greater people than the people that work on their brain. I don't know. Or that's, purely that's, on a physical.
That's, yeah. I mean, that's likely. That was Jaron Lanier's hope from the very beginning. He talked about that. And also just being able to swap viewpoints, being able to inhabit someone you're not, which we see in Second Life already. But even when you have a full 3D virtual body, that sense of presence is even much greater. And I think we'll hopefully see more of that empathy of people, you know, inhabiting a person who doesn't look like themselves or behave like themselves, and just to be able to experience. Maybe that becomes part of our education, where that's sort of a requirement to walk in someone else's shoes, so to speak, because it's very, very powerful.
So what do you think, you know, we're talking about all of this, and obviously, you know, it's something it's all going to come to us. It's going to come a little at a time. But to a lot of people, I think it's still just this thing on the horizon. It's not this, they hear about a self-driving car and it's, oh, this this crazy thing on the coast. This isn't, you know, this isn't affecting my life. What do you think, you know, the first things, and maybe it's Pokemon Go for of all things, it seems to have hit the public. But I mean, what do you think the earliest day-to-day impact technology will be on, you know, your average citizen's life?
You mean the stuff beyond what we have already? The next
right
thing?
Yeah, sort of the next thing that will really you know, change the way that the average person interacts with the world around them in this area.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, you know, we all point to the smartphone now, but the smartphone actually took a fairly long time to penetrate in the way that it did. I mean, cell phones were around for, I don't know, from the 80s, and then we had the big hunky brick version, and then we, you know, reduced to the flip, and even by the flip, not everybody was on board. And but you could see where it was going, and so did that count? Did the flip phone, or did it not really count until you had the smartphone and it became ubiquitous? So I'm not sure that there's going to be kind of this overnight thing where suddenly it appears. I think the smartphone was actually, and even the iPhone was not immediately everywhere. I think we kind of remember a little bit incorrectly. We remember the speed of this being faster than it was. It was decades in coming. And the internet itself, my gosh, I mean, I don't know. I've been online since 81. It's like, you know, it's like, that's a long time for an overnight success. This is like, this is not sudden. And so I think the first, I don't think there's going to be this kind of ubiquitous, I mean, even Pokemon, people see it, but they're not doing it. I mean, I don't know. It'd be interesting to know what the numbers are. I mean, maybe they're in millions, but it's still not like everybody. So I don't think it kind of works that way. I think there'll be, I mean, you can say, well, they're already in highways here. There's cars that are on autopilot for some of the period of time. I suspect that people will start going to arcades, VR arcades, where you pay some money and you have an experience like a theme park ride, which is kind of cool. You may not go back for a year, or you may not go back for a couple of years, but you have the experience. So that's one step that might be widespread. I think people are in the beginning. VR is not going to be something people do for long periods of time. I think it'll be something that they dip in and out of occasionally. Maybe your friend has a VR world set and you go over to play every once in a while. And that's kind of, they'll be going for a couple of years like that, maybe 5 years, and people have had at least one chance to try it. I think it's not going to like kind of like steamroll into our lives and then suddenly there it is and never goes away. I don't think it goes like that.
It'll be a gradual, just like the smartphone, yeah. Because there's people that I work with, older generation, they were resistant to smartphones, and now I see several of them with it, and they're like, well,
yeah,
I had to, and now that I have it, yeah. I don't know, I can't imagine life without it. Like, how did we do it before?
Right. But it took them how long? I mean, it took them, I don't know, 20 years, 5 years. I mean, it depends on where you want to count from, but, it's not, it takes a long time to kind of penetrate deeply into the culture. And also I wonder if we have, if we've left the period when we have ever have 100% penetration. And I think that the peak penetration may actually be starting to drop, meaning that you may only get like 80% ever. I don't know what even, I mean, I guess smartphones will probably be a peak, and, I mean, and it's probably very, very high.
I've seen homeless people and bums begging for change.
I know. I mean, I've seen the street sweepers in India have it, and I never thought that I would ever see them, with a cell phone. I would bet against that for sure.
I think it's generational. We'll see the people that are resistant or people older and are set in their ways. And then as, you know, new people grow up and this becomes just part of life, I think that you'll see the adoption reach closer to 99.
Yeah. And, you know, so like if I had to make a guess, you know, like wouldn't even 90% of the people had, say, a VR something in their house, I would put it, you know, 30 years. I mean, I think this is going to be a slow rollout, but I would say, I would flip it around and say, but I think that the effect of that is going to be far greater than what we're imagining right now. I think so. We kind of overestimate the immediate effect and we underestimate the long-term effect. So I think it's going to be a slower rollout, but I think that when it's there and done, I think it's going to be a lot bigger than we think it will be.
Well, thank you, Kevin. We appreciate you joining us for this podcast.
Hey, it was really great, you guys. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for making it so much fun.
Hey, I'm glad that we were the last podcast on your marathon 12-hour day.
Exactly. Hey, best to you guys. I really appreciate your interest in the book. Thanks for your great questions. And best of your continued podcast.
Is there anything you want to hit or anything you don't want us to? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's one question which you don't have to ask if you want, because everybody has asked it, which is what happens when the robots take over and kill us. So, you can ask it. I'll just give my standard answer, which I repeated, but go ahead. So let's go.